Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WVUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. To much of the world, Rwanda is a byword for genocide. But since the terrible slaughter of 1994, says veteran correspondent Stephen Kinzer, Rwanda has made an astonishing turn toward rebirth. It's taking a cue from the Asian tigers and is on its way, he says, to becoming a bright model for the developing world. It's no small thanks, says Kinzer, to Rwandan President Paul Kagame, a former refugee and rebel leader who is driving the country forward. Some say too hard, and we'll hear that view. This hour on Point, Stephen Kinzer on the rebirth of Rwanda. We will hear in this hour from Paul Rusesabagina, star of the story of the film Hotel Rwanda and an outspoken critic of President Paul Kagame. But joining us first from Chicago is Stephen Kinzer, award-winning, longtime correspondent for The New York Times. His new book is A Thousand Hills, Rwanda's Rebirth and the Man Who Dreamed It. Stephen Kinzer, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you.
Wonderful to have you. It's always great to talk with you. You've got an African story here and a remarkable one, but you open it of all the book, of all things, with a quote from Shakespeare, "Though we seemed dead, we did but sleep." Where are you pointing us right there, Stephen?
I was in Rwanda during the period I was working on this book when the president of Somalia showed up on a state visit. And that episode to me really crystallized what this book is all about. If you go back to the early 1990s, Somalia and Rwanda would probably have been the two most ruined countries in the world. The phrase failed state would not even begin to explain the hell into which they had fallen. And everybody who looked at these two countries would have predicted that they were headed for either harsh ethnic dictatorship or total constant chaos forever. And that is indeed what's happened in Somalia. And seeing this Somali president show up in comfortable, safe, progressive, enthusiastic Rwanda and beg for help made me realize how fully Rwanda has rebelled against its fate and gone off onto a path that absolutely no one could have predicted in the wake of the genocide.
I have to say, in all honesty, I couldn't have predicted it myself. I was in Mogadishu in those years, was in Kigali some months after the genocide there. You know, when the ground was still soft underfoot from all the buried bodies and the destruction was still so obvious, destroyed house after destroyed house right across that country, are Rwandans amazed at where they've come?
I think they are, and if you ever get back to Kigali, you certainly will be too. Here is now the safest capital in Africa. It's the only place where you can walk around at 11 o'clock at night with your laptop and your cell phone. That's actually true for much of the country. And I think Rwandans are very aware that something special is happening in their country. If they weren't, I think we would be in danger of falling back into the Hutu-Tutsi divide again. But it's the fact that Rwandans now have some excitement about the future, the sense that something really big is happening in their country, that has allowed them, I think, to put aside a kind of an intercommunal hatred that was drilled into them for so many years and focus on something very exciting.
We want to look at how that's happened. You put Rwanda's President Paul Kagame right at the heart of this turnaround. Still dangers there, still tensions, and we'll talk about those. But let's listen to him for just a moment. He's put economic development very high on his agenda, sees it as a way to move past Rwanda's bloody history and a lot of troubled history of Africa generally. Here he is in an interview at a conference in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, late last year.
We have sought to challenge some of the thinking that is common with many people, and which has been responsible for, in actual fact, underdevelopment on our continent. And that is thinking that aid will come and solve everything, or that other people will come from somewhere else and do what we ought to be doing ourselves for us. And it is very simple to understand that nobody owes us anything. Nobody owes Rwandans anything.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame, nobody owes Rwandans anything. He wants the country to do it and do it on its own. He's looking to new models for that. Introduce us to this man, Stephen Kinzer. He's at the heart of your book, A Thousand Hills.
You're right, and his story really is at the center of the book. Hearing him speak there takes me back to the time I was writing this book. I had the chance to spend more than 30 hours with this guy, which is something that no journalist has ever done. He's guarded. He's a little hard to get to know. He's a career intelligence agent, and he's certainly not just like a tangerine who peels in a minute. But over a period of many hours, I really did come to know him. He told me a lot of stories that I don't think he's ever told anyone before. Very briefly, this is the story. He was just 2 years old and coming from a well-born Tutsi family when a gang of Hutu during the very first massacres in Rwanda in 1959 stormed his house and were about to kill him.
You describe this amazing scene of a chauffeur driving across the countryside, plucking him and his family out of the gang's grasp.
Well, as you say, I like to tell history by telling exciting stories, and boy, are there a number of them in Kagame's life. He was just 2 years old when that exciting story happened, and it just gets more exciting after that. He grew up as a wretched refugee, along with hundreds of thousands of other Tutsi who had fled Rwanda and gone across the border into Uganda. By the time this new generation grew up and became teenagers, they began to realize that they were never going to be able to get home. They were discriminated against in the countries where they landed, so they couldn't stay there, but they also couldn't go home. So this was the labyrinth that imprisoned them. How do you get out? How do we get home? And it was Kagame and a couple of others who conceived a radical strategy to build a revolutionary movement in a way that no insurgent leader ever had in the history of clandestine warfare. They built this revolutionary force. They managed to go back to Rwanda. They overthrew the genocide government and then installed themselves to set out on what has become a very audacious rebellion against fate and history.
Now, importantly in this whole story, though ambiguously, given Rwanda's history, Paul Kagame is a Tutsi. We know that conflict between Hutu and Tutsi wasn't the whole story, but it was a huge piece of the story in 1994 and for years before that. There was a civil war and a genocide that were sort of interwoven here. We can't really understand Rwanda's comeback without understanding what that was all about. Paint the picture for us, Steve.
This is another one of the stories I try to tell and look back. How did we get to this point of the genocide? It really goes back to the colonial period. Back in the 1930s when Rwanda was a Belgian colony, the Belgians, like other white Europeans who had come to Rwanda, were super impressed with the Tutsi. The Tutsi were only about 15% of the population. But they were the monarchy. They were the ruling class. And to these Europeans, they seemed so sophisticated, so well-spoken, so appealing physically. They had built such a meticulously detailed political society that the Europeans decided these people can't be African. Mm. They're too smart for that. So a whole series of theories developed about where the Tutsi had come from. Many said Ethiopia, but then there were these theories that they had come from Anatolia, India, Melanesia, Atlantis, or my favorite, the Garden of Eden. Mm. So it was the Belgians who came up with this idea that the Tutsi came from somewhere else. And it was also the Belgians who brought in finely marked calipers and rulers to measure the width of foreheads and the length of noses of every citizen of Rwanda and give each one an identity card that said either Tutsi or Hutu.
Fateful move.
Those cards were used during the genocide to single out the victims. So when the Belgians in the late 1950s were under pressure, like all colonial powers, mm-hmm. to give independence mm-hmm. to their colonies, they decided, how are we going to give independence to Rwanda in a way that will allow us to continue controlling it? That's going to mean the Hutu are going to be in power because you're going to have open elections. So they radically changed sides in the space of just a few months and told the Tutsi, we don't want to rule with you anymore. We're now on the Hutu side. They promoted the ideology of Hutu supremacy, and that led to the hatred that later exploded in genocide.
And the civil war, the insurgency that you're describing, and those became entwined. In 1994, there was a genocide going underway and a Tutsi army, advancing on the heart of Rwanda.
It was a very bizarre situation. You have this army that is based on a group of the population that only is 15% of the people. And yet when it took over, 1994, right after the genocide, Kagame, the Tutsi who was the leader of the insurgent force, realized, I can't run this country because people here have been poisoned over decades with this idea that the Tutsi are monsters and only want to kill and enslave them. So they placed a Hutu government in power behind which Kagame and his friends exercised ultimate power. That was the way the post-revolutionary period began.
And now economic development at the heart of his plans. We'll come back and talk about that, but he's looking at building something like an Asian tiger path from poverty to prosperity in a single generation. You say there's a good chance he'll do it.
I wouldn't want to go so far as to say there's a good chance, but I'll tell you this. My friends in the development community, my friends who have devoted their whole lives to trying to find ways to pull poor countries out of poverty, are all focused on Rwanda. That's what led me to this project. Mama, da-dee-da. Mama, da-dee-da.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Rwanda climbing back from genocide, maybe to be Africa's new shining star. Longtime New York Times correspondent Stephen Kinzer is with us. His new book is A Thousand Hills, Rwanda's Rebirth and the Man Who Dreamed It. That man, the country's president, Paul Kagame. Stephen Kinzer is a big fan. It is not an uncheckered record that Kagame has, he says, but that he's doing or trying to do something that has maybe never quite been done here before. Have you seen the transformation? What about the ambitious but unbending leadership of Paul Kagame? Is this just what Rwanda needs? Is it human rights abuse, as some would say? Did you see Hotel Rwanda, the movie? What do you make of the star of that story condemning Kagame? We'll hear in a few minutes from Paul Rusesabagina, who's got a different view of what's going on in Rwanda today. But Stephen Kinzer, give us your metrics. How do you measure, development experts, how do they look at Rwanda and say, yes, since the genocide, it's made incredible progress? What are the metrics?
There's a very interesting aspect to this Rwanda story, which is just one of the many things that drew me to it. All during my career, I've worked very closely with people in the development community and people in the human rights community. And in fact, I not only feel sympathetic to them, I feel myself sort of a part of that effort, that community. Rwanda is the first place I have ever been where the development community and the human rights community are actually on opposite sides. People in the development community are so thrilled about Rwanda. For example, Paul Farmer, the guy who spent years in Haiti and was the subject of that great book, Mountains Beyond Mountains,
has more or less moved his
operation from Haiti to the place in the world that's the most promising. It's Rwanda. The director of the big Millennium Village project there told me, this is the only country on the planet that has the chance to go from absolute poverty to middle income in the space of a generation. So they're totally thrilled by Rwanda. On the human rights side, people are much less enthusiastic. Paul Kagame is an autocrat. This is not an open society. And actually, many people would argue that all you need to have another genocide is to open up this society and allow sort of Swiss-style democracy. That would produce the forces that will unleash another Holocaust in Rwanda. So there's an argument between those people who say the country is progressing and it's meeting the needs of its citizens, which are essentially, I want to have enough money to buy food for my family. I want to have medical care. I want to have hope for the future. And on the other hand, those people who are saying something dangerous is being built here and it might not be so different from these big man systems that have ruined so many other African countries.
We'll look at those political tensions and the leftover tensions very much so from the genocide era. But what about the economy? You quote from your conversations with Kagame, him saying, you know, on progress, why can't we do it? Why should we be known for being poor or for killing each other? Has God cursed us? Is it what we deserve? Can't we do things differently? 8 million people, small country, plenty of poverty in its background. How are they trying to build this brilliant economy that Kagame imagines?
Well, you mentioned one interesting aspect of Rwanda, and that is that although it's pretty heavily populated, it's a very small country. It's only about the size of Maryland. Mm. And that, I think, attracts a lot of people from the outside, too, because it seems fixable. It seems doable. Even the most brilliant leadership and aid could not turn around these hugely complex countries like the Congo or Nigeria. But this is a country where everyone speaks the same language, same religion, same traditions. It's compact, so it seems doable. Now, you ask how. I want to relate a little exchange that I had with President Kagame during one of my interviews with him. Mm. I said to him, the outside world has been trying to find out how to help Africa for more than 50 years, and we've poured in so many tens of billions of dollars, but no one has been able to figure out how to do this, how to make Africa prosperous. Why is that? Mm. And he said, I reject the premise of your question. It's not correct that no one has figured out how to do it. Actually, if you look at those thousands of reports, they all say the same thing. Have a government that's not corrupt. Build your infrastructure. Educate people. Have gender equality. There are about 10 simple points on this list. It's not that we don't know what to do. It's that nobody does it. And I think he's seeing this as a project that should be just as possible in Rwanda as it was in Taiwan or South Korea or Thailand or those other countries that went from real poverty to prosperity in a very short time.
But I keep trying to get the detail of what that would mean. I mean, Rwanda has grown coffee. They're selling coffee now to Starbucks and Costco on big deals. What else does Rwanda have? They're talking about becoming a high-tech center. Is that seen as realistic? Could they build an IT information technology, you know, dynamo in little 8 million population, super crowded Central African Rwanda?
It has to be, because that's really their only way out. It's not a big enough country to produce large agricultural exports. They want to have everything value-added inside Rwanda. And you're absolutely right. What they want to do is make themselves the trade and commercial hub of Central and East Africa. This is a fabulously rich region, but it's plagued by corruption, poor infrastructure, and terrible political leadership. Now, the idea of the Kagame government is to educate the people to a very high level so this can become the internet center, the place with the biggest airport in that region of the world, a place where there won't be any corruption, where business will be able to operate freely. They want to build a railroad from Rwanda right out to the coast, and they're hoping that their advantages in governance, that is the lack of corruption and the relative efficiency there compared to all the surrounding countries, can be turned into an asset that will make that place into a real business and commercial hub.
George Bush was there in Rwanda in February this year, visited the country's genocide memorial, but the progress the country's made impressed him. Here he is standing beside President Kagame in Kigali, praising the progress of Rwanda.
It's hard to believe that a country could recover so quickly from such a horrible moment. It's hard to believe that there can be hope after a devastating period of time like that, and yet there is.
President Bush in Rwanda. It is hard to believe. I remember standing and seeing people who, months after the genocide, meeting each other for the first time on the street since the genocide, just staring at each other in disbelief that they were still alive. So many had died, they assumed that friends and family were dead. There's that scar as well, and we have questions on it. Let's begin to go to them. Virginia Beach, Virginia, Hunter is calling. Hunter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just wondering what role faith, forgiveness, and reconciliation has played in a country that's seen so much hatred and horror, and how that's played as sort of maybe a fundamental shift in the society.
Let us pick it up. Stephen Kinzer, how about it? You write a lot about this front.
Very interesting question. When you look at what Rwanda has to do for the future, there's this huge challenge we just talked about. How do you take a miserably poor country and pull it out of poverty? This alone is an overwhelming challenge, and that's the central challenge of Rwanda. But Rwanda also has another challenge, a challenge that's not quantifiable, a challenge that economists and other scientists can't help you with. They have a psycho-spiritual challenge. How do you heal a society that has been so terribly ripped asunder with one group setting out to murder the entire other group? What you have is a situation where there's up to 1 million murderers in Rwanda. but it's not possible to try them. You couldn't possibly have a million trials. They don't have judges. They don't have lawyers. There's no space in the prisons for those people. Besides, we need them to work. They have to be out producing. So on the one hand, you can't punish them. On the other hand, you have to punish them because it's the impunity that these people learned during past massacres and mini-genocides that allowed them to do this. And if you don't punish them, they're likely to do it again. Now, how do you get people in society to reconcile? How do you get to a scene that I saw and that I report in my book where I saw a woman whose husband and children had been murdered by one of her neighbors with a machete. And this woman had a huge machete cut across her face because the guy thought he had killed her too, sitting on a log next to the guy who did this, and say that she forgives him. As I have watched these unbelievable scenes and tried to probe a little more deeply into how you can get someone to do something so irrational as to forgive the person that massacred your whole family, I see that really the key factor in many of these cases is religious faith. Pastors have played a big role in telling people this is what God wants you to do. This is how people in Rwanda are pulled above rationalism, you can say, in our cultures. To do something beyond the rational is often to do something spiritual or religious. And religion really has played an important role in trying to convince Rwandans that they should embark on a process of forgiveness and reconciliation that truly seems almost unimaginable to those of us who come to see it from the outside.
Of course, it's complicated, and you report how in history religion played a divisive role as well. Both sides here. Nihai is calling from Hollis, Massachusetts. Nihai, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Tom. I just want to make a few comments. First of all, being from Congo, Africa, I want to congratulate your guests for explaining such succinct terms the colonial dealings that actually led are the root cause of the problems in Africa. It's the first time I hear that, you know, said so simply and, you know, and rightly.
That colonial background, yes.
Yes, and also it's a nice change to have to hear a positive story about Africa on the air. And now my comment is like, now is Rwanda going to make it? You know, they might stand a chance, given that they have no oil, no diamonds or gold to, you know, mess up the things, and these are actually the doom of Africa. So they might do it.
They might do it, says the voice from neighboring Congo, and happy to hear something positive. And Nihai, thank you very much for that. But it is complicated, and the message has not always been one of a sparkling future. A lot of Americans became acquainted with some of the details in the 2004 film Hotel Rwanda. It introduced the world to the story of Paul Rusesabagina. He joins us in just a moment from Belgium, but let's listen back. Here's from Hotel Rwanda, Don Cheadle playing the hotel manager credited with saving so many lives in Kigali in the midst of genocide.
My name is Paul Rusesabagina. I am the house manager of the most luxurious hotel in the capital of Rwanda, a place that my family and I happily called our home until the day everything changed.
Daddy? There are soldiers on the street.
And it got worse in a hurry. Paul Rusesabagina now makes his home in Belgium. He's become an outspoken critic of President Paul Kagame. He joins us today, of all things, like Stephen Kinzer from Chicago. Paul Rusesabagina, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you very much.
You have been honored around the world for your role during the genocide. The United States gave you the Presidential Medal of Freedom. At home, you've been a subject of controversy. You've been very critical of Paul Kagame and much less impressed by his job as president. Why are you not excited as Steve Kinzer is about the vision Kagame has laid out for Rwanda and the progress he's made?
I'm not very much impressed because of various reasons. Because, first of all, if you want to develop a nation, we have to go back to our past, look at it, sit down, talk about it. Go back beyond the colonization era. Before colonization, everybody knows that Hutus were slaves to Tutsis. When colonizers came in, they helped Tutsis, who were oppressing Hutus, to oppress them much more. This is why, when Rwanda became independent in 1962, it was the result of a revolution. The Hutu majority getting rid of colonization, and at the same time, their countrymen, who unfortunately fled the country and went away to exile. These are the people who later on came back fighting from Uganda in 1990. As Mr. Kinzer said, he's very right, impunity has been a problem in Rwanda. In 1959, 60, 61, 62, and so on, when Tutsis fled the country, Hutus took over everything from them. They took over houses, land, cattle, everything. And Tutsis fled the country empty hands. The war that started in Rwanda by those who 3 decades later came back fighting on October 1st, 1990, brought another element. Again, I saw people rooting other people's gun, and I even saw that time the then government selling on auction people's properties in shops.
Mr. Rusesabagina, if I may ask you, and first I have to say I've been a guest at your hotel in Kigali. I appreciate everything that you did there, but I believe you're Hutu. Kagame is Tutsi. Are you with the are you perpetuating this very old, confrontation? Is it time to get by it? Is it possible?
No, this is not what I'm saying. What I want to reach is that since 1959 to date, nothing have changed. Because in 1994, I was in Rwanda, and I did not leave Rwanda, as maybe some people think, until September 6, 1996.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I saw people coming in, the RPF people coming in, breaking doors, shops' doors, jumping behind the counter, selling what they never bought, and they never knew where it came from. I saw people occupying other people's houses, and even today, 14 years later, it is the same thing.
Paul Rusesabagina, stand by for just a moment. Stephen Kinzer, we've just got half a minute before the break. We'll come back and look at this more. But you hear this abiding unhappiness that Mr. Rusesabagina is articulating here. It can sound like Tutsi, Hutu, endless confrontation. Is that the way you read it, Stephen, or something else?
I think that's the way people in certainly the government in Kigali would read it. This use of even the words Hutu and Tutsi is now a taboo in Rwanda. Outside, we still use it. We talk a lot about that. But in Rwanda, this is really the one taboo on a public discourse. For example, it's okay to complain that the government is being run by a small clique. It's not allowed to say it's being run by a small clique of Tutsi. It's okay to say people are suffering in Rwanda, but you're not allowed to say Hutu are suffering in Rwanda. That is the one big limit on public discourse in Rwanda, and I think you can see why.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Rwanda climbing back from genocide, maybe to be Africa's new shining star, maybe a shining star to the entire developing world. What does it mean if Rwanda succeeds, for Africa, for the rest of the developing world? And could this all slide back to Hutu Tutsi bloodbath? Stephen Kinzer's new book is A Thousand Hills, Rwanda's Rebirth and the Man Who Dreamed It. Is he on to a miracle here? Does he have stars in his eyes? Could this be the new jewel of Africa? Stephen Kinzer joins us today from Chicago. We're also joined from Chicago by Paul Rusesabagina. He was manager of the Hotel Mille Collines in Kigali, Rwanda, credited for saving many lives during the genocide there. His story was the basis for the movie Hotel Rwanda. He was played by Don Cheadle there. He was given the Medal of Freedom in 2005. His autobiography is called An Ordinary Man. He is critical of President Kagame. We've got a call right now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Tim. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well, thanks. What do you know?
I used to be the head of the Human Rights Watch office in Rwanda, and I want to push your guest a little more on the last point, which is to talk about the ethnic conflict more, because one of the realities that I've seen traveling back and forth with Rwanda, I've been living there on and off for 15 years, is the fact that almost all of the economic development is benefiting, unfortunately, one ethnic group. Even though you can't talk about Hutu and Tutsi today, the part of the reason that you can't is because it's mostly the Tutsi who are getting rich and the Hutu who are not. And beyond that, it's also an issue of the genocide survivors, the people who were Tutsi but who were in Rwanda before, who are mostly left out of the system. The people who are really benefiting now, who are getting the economic development, are in fact the people who primarily were former refugees who come back, those from Uganda, those from Congo, and from Burundi and elsewhere.
Tim, stick with us. Stephen Kinzer, what do you say to these observations from the former head of Human Rights Watch in Rwanda?
I think those comments are very thoughtful, and I think there's a lot of truth to them. This class of returning refugees has definitely become very visible in Rwanda. In many cases, I think this is very positive. These people bring back not only big bank accounts they accumulated during their lives abroad, but webs of contacts and understanding about business that many people in Rwanda, which was highly isolated, never developed. I do think there is a need and a challenge for Rwanda to be sure that economic development becomes more equalized. I don't think it's true that it's all benefiting one group. I do see some very enterprising Hutu entrepreneurs, and I do see some very promising signs out, for example, in the coffee industry, which is manned almost exclusively by Hutu, including a lot of Hutu women. The larger question I think that this brings up is this. This subject, are the Tutsi benefiting disproportionately from economic development in Rwanda, would be one that would be very difficult to discuss inside Rwanda for the reason we just talked about, and that is that any discussion of ethnic or racial differences or group differences or whatever you want to call them is considered highly sensitive there. So on the one hand, this is great because we don't bring up these differences and we try to forget them, and President Kagame is always preaching, we're only Rwandans now, we have no other identity. So that sounds great. But on the other hand, what if people really are building some resentments inside them about things they can't talk about? That could be a potential destabilizing factor over the long run, no doubt about it.
Tim, let me just put the question to you. Stephen Kinzer said earlier that this may be a country where development folks and human rights folks part ways. Do you see that happening? There's clearly excitement in the development community about Rwanda at the same time as real issues here with freedom of the press and the way and lack of democracy and much more. Is this a parting of the ways story?
I think it is true, but it's also an echo of history, because if you look at Rwanda before the genocide, the exact same division existed. There's a great book that by Peter Juven that is about the way in which the economic development community was all for the Habyarimana regime and was very surprised when the genocide happened, whereas the human rights community before the genocide was warning about the divisions that were there. So I would be very cautionary. I think that it's true that, in fact, there is this division. But the past of Rwanda suggests that really you might want to listen to the human rights people a little more.
Mm. Tim, thanks very much for your call. Paul Rusesabagina in Chicago. What about the argument that what Rwanda needs above all is economic development, and even if the distribution of benefits is imperfect at the beginning, there's a kind of human rights price when a country is poor, that the country should just forge ahead, as Kagame says, try and put aside ethnic differences and let development be the balm to all sides here. Or do you have confidence it can ultimately work for everyone, Tutu, Hutsi, all Rwandans?
Well, I do not believe that this is the problem. You might be white and you might be black, but the most important thing to all of us is to remember that we have our rights start and end somewhere. This is what people should have in mind, what we should teach our neighbors. But again, in Rwanda, you can never develop a nation. You can never reconcile a nation when justice is a one-way street. In Rwanda, justice is a one-way street because today you have Hutus who committed the genocide, and they committed a genocide. Those people are facing trials. But on the other hand, we have Tutsis who committed war crimes and crimes against other crimes against humanity, who are rather trying and convicting those Hutus who are considered to be genocidaires. In such circumstances, it is, I don't see it easy to say, to pretend, to reconcile a nation. Today, Hutu children are not allowed to be called survivals. There is a survival organization association, which is called Ibuka, and financed, sponsored by the government. That organization that does not pay even school fees, tuitions, for Hutu children who also lost their parents in the genocide. Simply, they are not survivors. So this becomes a problem again. When we think about it, when we see what is going on, inequalities, it becomes a problem when it comes to reconciliation. There are so many other problems, but I think that the most important thing to be done here would be to think about a truth and reconciliation and accept who we are, a truth and reconciliation whereby people come around the table, sit down as Hutus and Tutsis, because we can never hide this forever.
Will you go back and run for office yourself one day, Mr. Rusesabagina? Stephen Kinzer speculates that you might.
Here I'm not campaigning. I'm just proposing what should be done. I'm proposing just what should be done. You know, we know that there are Hutus who committed a genocide. There are people who are being tried. So those who committed the genocide was committed by Hutus. So they are there. We cannot say they are no Hutus. They are there. We cannot say that they are no Tutsis because they have been victims during the genocide. This is not an argument to me. So the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, whereby Hutus and Tutsis would come around the table, sit down, talk, remember our history, and remember our past. Think about a better present and a much better future for the future generation. That is the only way to build on a rock and not on the sand.
Mm. Paul Rusesabagina, whose story was at the heart of the movie Hotel Rwanda, his autobiography is An Ordinary Man. He joins us today from Chicago. Mr. Rusesabagina, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Stephen Kinzer, you write about Mr. Rusesabagina's case in the book as well. He was lauded when this film was first screened in Kigali, and then he was turned into a target for real strict, stiff government criticism. How do you see him? Where does he sit in the kind of constellation of political voices and powers in Rwanda now?
Well, Paul Rusesabagina is a very active political figure. He's certainly the leading opponent to President Kagame anywhere in the world, and I think the anti-Kagame forces are kind of attracted toward him. And you hear a very different kind of discourse from the people that are outside Rwanda, from the people that are inside. He just said that he would look forward to the time when people could sit down together at a table as Hutu and Tutsi. That's not going to happen in Rwanda as long as this ruling group is in power. This violates everything they believe. They want you to sit down only as Rwandans and leave those other identities behind.
Now, is that realistic?
You
write about sort of grinding subterranean tensions in spite of that official position.
So, yeah, this is a very fundamental question. Are you repressing something that's going to explode later, or you're trying slowly to diminish some tensions that can be very dangerous to society? I think that as long as Rwanda is progressing economically, as long as Rwandans are as excited and enthusiastic as they are now about what their future holds, the ethnic bugaboo is not going to come back again. But if we start to get into a position in which, for one reason or another, the Rwandan example starts to falter, if they're not making progress, if the economy falls apart, if security falls apart, if something happens to President Kagame, if for some reason this hope and enthusiasm begins to falter, then I think in the back of the minds of a lot of people, there still is this residue of hatred from the pre-genocide period, and I fear what might happen.
Let's go to Karen, calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi there, Tom, and hello, Mr. Kinzer. You've gone almost the entire program without talking about the women of Rwanda, which
great.
I am so disappointed.
Well, we include them when we say Rwandan, Karen. I don't know about you, but we certainly do.
But they specifically need attention, support. I urge everyone listening to Google Rwanda women, to find out about what they're doing, to send the money that they need, because they're doing the work. They have accomplished something absolutely incredible. I know that Stephen can address this, but I did want to mention that when the slaughter was concluded, the population of Rwanda was about 70% women, and most of those women had either witnessed or themselves had been brutalized in ways we can't talk about on the radio. It's just too horrific to imagine. Those women turned around and literally picked up the pieces of people, of their children, of their families. They did the work of feeding them, cleaning up every horror you can imagine. And now they are under the radar, apparently. They don't get a lot of attention in the press, but they are in the forefront of every economic, political, and as Stephen said, the psychic and spiritual challenge of recovery is literally being done by the women. They are the ones forgiving. They are the ones trying to restore sanity to the children. And there's a lot more that they need, but they certainly, number one, need credit, attention, recognition.
Karen, let us do that right here and right now, and thank you for your call. Stephen Kinzer, no shortage of attention to exactly what Karen's talking about in your book, A Thousand Hills, not least the very heavy representation of women in Rwanda's legislature now.
You're right. There is a larger percentage of women in the Rwandan parliament than in any country in the world. I think it's now 49%. So you do have this aspect that the caller was talking about of how the social rebuilding has really fallen onto the shoulders of women. But then there's this other piece, which is that political leadership has fallen very heavily on women, too. One of the things that visitors to Rwanda always remark on is what's called the awesome women that are essentially running that government. Once you get past President Kagame, you see that, for example, the trial system in which they are trying to figure out what to do with these 1 million murderers is being run by a woman. The National Reconciliation Commission, which is dealing with arguably the country's biggest challenge, is run by a woman. The foreign minister, who's probably Kagame's chief confidant, is a woman. Some of the leading senators are. So they are playing a very active role, not just in reconstructing society from below, but in directing it from above.
Karen, thanks for your call. Let's go to Shifa in Boston. Shifa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just would like to say thank you for this program. I'm an African. On this beautiful day, I'm driving a cab without the AC. That's
right.
This could not be a better day. I just would like to say, first, I would like to thank your guest who has taken his time to bring us this good news about Africa, especially for us who live here, who are bombarded with all this negative thing about Africa day in and day out. But I'd like to say, I know that politics is generally unpredictable. But why is it so unpredictable in Africa, going back to like Eritrea and Ethiopia in the early 90s, they have settled their problems, and they were hopeful, they were at least by the Western countries, categorized as countries that will be a hope for Africa and new generation, new leaders. And a few years later, they have gone to war with each other. Shifar,
time is short. We've got the gist of it, and I thank you for your call, Stephen Kinzer. We've just got a minute and a half here. But you go to Shifar wants to know, you know, A, thanks for a good story. B, why has it been so hard in Africa? And where you ultimately go in your book is what it might mean for Africa if Rwanda continues on this path of success. Speak to that, if you would.
When I asked people around Rwanda why it is that this is happening, why did Rwanda get to this point where this little country that has never really played a strategic or any other kind of important role in African history suddenly is becoming so interesting and the star of Africa, I used to hear the same phrase over and over again as an answer. And they would say, in the end, it all comes down to leadership. Kagame is really a fascinating figure, and if there's one really bright spot in this story, it is his vision, his very innovative idea about how to develop a country. If, however, there is a weakness in this process, I think it also is the dominant role that this one figure plays. So he has a very exciting story, which I tell in my book, but the fact that so much revolves around him is also reason for concern. And especially when you look at the history of other great promising stars of Africa, it's pretty depressing record. Even Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe was at one time hailed as a great liberator. So all of this makes us cautious, but I do agree with your caller and one other caller who used that same phrase. There is a thirst for good news about Africa, and this could be some of it.
A pulsating sense of enthusiasm and optimism, Stephen Kinzer reports out of all places, Rwanda. Steve Kinzer, I hope you stay on top of this tour. It's going to be fascinating to see where it goes from here, and we hope you'll bring it to us. Thanks very much for the new book, A Thousand Hills, and thanks for being with us today, Steve.
My pleasure.
Stephen Kinzer. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Nizar, 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 Nizar